Major Edmondson. From 13,500 feet, they piled on, dropping 46 500-pound bombs. Two more failed to drop, claiming 3 to 6 hits on the biggest target, the Jura. Night was almost here, but it could not come soon enough to save the Jura. Admiral Takama ordered the cruiser scuttled. Takama moved his flag from the damaged Akizuki to the Murasame, and both ships took off the Jura's crew. At 6:30, Harusame and Yudachi fired torpedoes at the abandoned cruiser. Not even this was simple. The Jura broke in two, the bow sinking, but the stern remaining afloat until the Yudachi dispatched it with gunfire around 7 p.m. off Cape Astrolabe, Santa Isabel. The Akizuki suffered heavy damage to her boiler room, 11 dead and 22 injured, but she made it back to Japan. It was a significant success for the Americans on a day in which the 1st Marine Air Wing was under siege. 5 Zeros of the Tainan Air Group appeared over Lunga around 2 p.m., at about the same time as a raid of 16 Betty bombers from Rabaul, escorted by 12 Zeros from the Hiyo, operating out of Buin, appeared. They were met by 11 Wildcats under Major Davis, resulting in a wild melee that resulted in the loss of 2 Bettys, 1 Tainan Zero and 1 Hiyo Zero. Then, a little before 4 p.m., came 12 Val dive bombers and 12 Zeros from the carrier Junyo under Lieutenant Shiga Yoshio. With no aerial opposition, the Junyo strike bombed and strafed Henderson Field at will, then returned to their carrier with no losses. But they also inflicted no losses on the Americans. All they did was hit the boneyard of wrecked aircraft south of the runway. The siege, at least the aerial portion of it, was over for the moment. The Japanese had launched 82 aircraft in 6 waves against Henderson Field. Of those 82, 11 Zeros, 2 Bettys, and 1 Army reconnaissance plane were lost, along with their crews. 2 more damaged Zeros were written off. For all this effort, the Japanese had shot down exactly 2 Wildcats, of which both pilots survived. Another 4 were shot up, and 6 were damaged by operational accidents or the quagmire of an airstrip. That left exactly 8 fighters immediately flyable. But after this dugout Sunday, as it became known because the day-long series of air attacks had kept the men in their dugout shelters, Henderson Field was still in American hands. The 1st Marine Air Wing was in desperate shape, but the Marines and soldiers had done their part, holding back the Japanese attack by land, by air, and even a little by sea. The question remained, could the U.S. Navy do its part? Chapter 11. Not quite midway. The Imperial Navy's fears about the cost of the repeated delays in the 17th Army's attack on Henderson Field were being realized. At 12:45 p.m. on October 24th, mere hours before the Sendai Division was to attack, the USS Enterprise Group met the Hornet Group northeast of the New Hebrides, forming Task Force 61 under Rear Admiral Kincaid. Task Force 61 had 2 component parts. One was Task Force 16 under Kincaid's personal direction, featuring the Enterprise screened by the new battleship South Dakota, heavy cruiser Portland, light anti-aircraft cruiser San Juan, and 7 destroyers. Task Force 17 under Rear Admiral Murray had the Hornet screened by the heavy cruisers Northampton and Pensacola, light anti-aircraft cruisers San Diego and Juno, and 6 destroyers. In Admiral Halsey's words, "Until the Enterprise arrived, our plight had been almost hopeless. Now we had a fighting chance." The reason? Admiral Halsey believed carrier power varies as the square. 2 carriers are 4 times as powerful as 1. Halsey's mathematic proof of this formula was somewhat lacking. So too was his intelligence information. Pearl Harbor thought Halsey's ships would only face the Shokaku and Zuikaku, 2 fleet carriers. In fact, they were also facing 1 light carrier, Zuiho, as well as the Junyo, the latter larger than a light carrier, if not quite a fleet carrier, which could be counted as 3 or even 4 aircraft carriers, with the power, under Halsey's formula, of 9 or even 16 carriers. The numbers perhaps expose the bizarre nature of Halsey's formula. Nevertheless, as Halsey told Admiral Nimitz a few weeks earlier, "I had to begin throwing punches almost immediately. As a consequence, quick decisions had to be made." And Admiral Halsey made them, sending out orders to Admiral Kincaid, "Make a sweep around North Santa Cruz Islands, thence southwesterly east of San Cristobal to area in Coral Sea, in position to intercept enemy forces approaching Guadalcanal to Lagi." It was a bold, aggressive move, unlike anything seen from Admiral Gormley, going outside the air cover, such as it was, of Espiritu Santo, into waters visited by no American carrier in 2 months. The idea was to place the Enterprise and Hornet outside the range of Japanese air power on Rabaul, but able to strike from the east at the flank of, and hopefully ambush, the Japanese carriers. In short, it was to be another Midway. These were the same maneuvers that enabled the badly outnumbered U.S. Navy to win at Midway. But past performance is no guarantee of future results. It was almost dawn on October 25th when Admiral Nagumo was awakened by an aide. He gave the admiral a report from one of Kido Butai's protecting fighters. "I have shot down an enemy plane, apparently a scout." That news got the little admiral bolt upright. "Cut refueling, turn the carriers around and head due north." In fact, they actually headed north-northeast at 20 knots, sending out numerous scout planes. Admiral Nagumo was assuming the scout had made a full contact report. The turn was intended to throw off subsequent American searches and attacks. While Kido Butai was headed north, Admiral Kondo had received a report from Base Air Force that one of its scout planes had sighted 2 battleships, 4 heavy cruisers, 1 light cruiser, and 12 destroyers 30 miles east of Rennell Island. Overstated in strength, this was Admiral Lee's Task Force 64, built around the battleship Washington. Frustrated by their inability to locate the American carriers, Kondo ordered Nagumo to attack this group. Maybe the battleship would point the way to the missing carriers. But Nagumo refused, reasoning that the 340-mile distance from his carriers to the battleship was too long for his aircraft. Admiral Nagumo's about-face and the subsequent inability to strike at the battleship seems to have been the final straw for Admiral Yamamoto. That afternoon, Nagumo received a message from Yamamoto. Among the highlights from the deliberately insulting dispatch was Yamamoto urging Nagumo to attack with vigor. Now, it was Admiral Nagumo's turn to be angry. He summoned Kusaka and showed him the message, saying he could not ignore it. Nagumo asked for the support of his longtime chief of staff. "I admit I've objected to your suggestions, but you are the commander and must make the final decisions," said Admiral Kusaka. "It's your battle. If you really want to head south, I'll go along with your verdict." After this empty show of support, Kusaka went on to remind the admiral that they had not yet located the enemy fleet, while they would likely be found by B-17s from Espiritu Santo. Kusaka concluded with pure sophistry, "But now that your mind is made up, I want you to know that we shall not be destroyed without first destroying the enemy." With that reassurance in hand, Admiral Nagumo had his fleet refuel and, at about 9 p.m., turned to head south at 20 knots. Admiral Halsey was indeed hitting the ground running, but in the process he may have run over a few of his subordinates, in particular Admiral Kincaid. One of Admiral Halsey's administrative priorities was to assemble as many of his old staff as he could. These were people who knew his ways, knew how to handle him, and shared his aggressive philosophy. The defeatism of Admiral Gormley would be eradicated. Among these staffers was Commander Leonard J. Ham, Dow. Dow had been Admiral Halsey's communications officer, but he was currently on the Enterprise, on which he had served as fighter director officer since before the war. Halsey later told Admiral Nimitz that he debated for a long time whether he should order Dow to join him and leave the Enterprise looking for a new fighter director officer, on the eve of battle, no less. He believed with fleet communications so poor, he needed someone he could trust. In addition, Commander John H. Griffin, aboard the Enterprise as a member of Admiral Kincaid's staff, could immediately replace him. Griffin had been the head of the fighter director school on Oahu, had been trained by the Royal Air Force, and had a deep understanding of the theory of fighter direction. That Griffin had never directed fighters in a carrier battle apparently did not bother Halsey. In fairness, communications were indeed a major issue for Admiral Halsey, though not necessarily related to the staff. Halsey's plan for another Midway by having the carriers make a sweep around North Santa Cruz Islands had, as he explained to Admiral Nimitz about a week later, one caveat. The carriers were to sweep past Santa Cruz only if no enemy comes down. In other words, if no large enemy force appeared north of the Solomons. Somehow, that particular aspect of the plan did not make it into Halsey's orders to Admiral Kincaid. It's always the little things. As ordered, Admiral Kincaid spent most of October 25th headed northwest at 22 knots. The Enterprise kept a combat air patrol operating while the Hornet kept a strike spotted on deck to be launched as soon as the enemy carriers were located. To locate said carriers, Admiral Fitch sent out from Espiritu Santo 10 Catalinas and 6 B-17s. The seaplane tender Ballard braved the malaria and moved to Vanikara, at the south end of the Santa Cruz Islands, to maintain the PBYs. The reports came in fast and furious. At 9:48 a.m., after a mauling by a few Zeros from the Junio, Lieutenant Mario Sesso's B-17 reported contact with Admiral Conda's advance force. Admiral Fitch sent a dozen B-17s after this force. 10 minutes later, a Catalina commanded by Lieutenant J.G. Warren B. Matthew, after a mauling by two Peets from the Kirishima that produced 76 holes, reported finding Admiral Abe's vanguard force. It was at 10 a.m. that the first truly interesting report came in from a Catalina commanded by Lieutenant J.G. Robert G. Lampshire. He initially reported unidentified task forces, which he later specified were carriers launching fighters. At 11:03, he added two more carriers to his report. Course 145 degrees southeast, speed 25 knots. That is, bearing 287 degrees true, northwest, and 355 miles from Admiral Kincaid. Also 250 miles northeast of Henderson Field, and able to support an attack thereon. These were interesting times indeed. Monitoring all the sighting reports from Noumea, Admiral Halsey reached his own conclusions. He dispatched an order to Admiral Kincaid and Admiral Lee, one that would encapsulate the new attitude emanating out of Noumea and electrify the men fighting in the South Pacific. The order read simply, "Strike. Repeat. Strike. COMSOPAC sends action CTF 61 and 64. Unfortunately, at that moment, Admiral Kincaid had his hands full. While flying combat air patrol, Wildcat pilot Lieutenant J.G. William K. Blair suffered a mechanical breakdown that greatly reduced his engine power and made it almost impossible to fly straight and level with his gear down. He was allowed to attempt a forced landing on the Enterprise, but in trying to execute the hazardous landing, he did not lower his tailhook, nor did the landing signal officer notice it. As a result, Blair's Wildcat ripped through the crash barrier, bounced, and plowed into parked SBDs forward, knocking one overboard and wrecking three more in addition to Blair's fighter. Five aircraft were totaled. Fortunately, although four were injured, no one was killed. But since he had destroyed five U.S. planes at once, Blair's ruthless squadron mates called him a Japanese ace. Because the American and Japanese carriers were on almost a head-on course and thus rapidly closing the range, Admiral Kincaid calculated that an afternoon airstrike on the Japanese carriers might be feasible. He sped up to 27 knots. But he faced a problem whose scope had been underrated. The wind was coming from the southeast, as it almost always did in this region, from behind him. To conduct flight operations, he had to turn almost completely around, which meant to launch an attack his carriers had to steam into well within the maximum range of their aircraft. The Japanese, with the wind coming straight at them, had no such issue and could launch as they steamed along. This was a serious disadvantage for the Americans. Rather curiously, instead of using the aircraft already spotted and ready for launch on the deck of the Hornet, Admiral Kincaid had the Enterprise's Air Group 10 prepare for the afternoon attack. His logic appears to have been twofold. First, the Enterprise's Wildcats had wing fuel tanks, which gave them slightly longer range than those of the Hornet, who only had belly tanks. Second, Kincaid seems to have studied the battles of the Coral Sea, Midway, and Eastern Solomons, and concluded that the U.S. airstrikes needed a second wave, like the Japanese managed to do. His plan, therefore, was to prepare the Enterprise strike while closing the range. Then, once Air Group 10 had found the Japanese, the follow-up strike from the Hornet could be immediately launched. More properly, the Hornet strike would be the follow-up to the follow-up, because the Enterprise strike would be preceded by six pairs of Dauntlesses also launched by the Enterprise. Launched at 1:36, 12 members of Scouting 10, under Lieutenant Commander James R. Bucky Lee, would search the sector of 280 degrees true, slightly northwest, to 10 degrees true, slightly northeast, to a range of 200 miles. The Enterprise would then launch a strike of 16 Wildcats, 12 Dauntlesses, and 7 Avengers to go out 150 miles to attack whatever the scouts found. But the strike group was star-crossed. Timing and fuel seemed to be major issues for the pilots. Lieutenant J.G. Stanley Swede Vatisa of Fighting 10, a former SPD pilot, was furious. By his calculations, they were still 250 miles from the Japanese carriers. It was an impossible mission for the green pilots of Air Group 10, because their aircraft simply did not carry the fuel for it. Betas slammed on his chartboard and loudly opined that Admiral Kincaid was a stupid ass. He stormed to the flag bridge looking for blood, later saying, "I didn't give a damn if they court-martialed me." This supposedly lowly lieutenant proceeded to loudly lecture the admiral's staff that this lengthy mission would end with the green pilots making their first night landings on the Enterprise. After saying his piece, he returned to find Lieutenant Commander James Thomas, head of Bombing 10, waiting for him. "Don't be so hasty," Thomas said. "We'll do an out and in." That indeed was Admiral Kincaid's plan. The strike group was to travel out 150 miles on the median line of the search, 325 degrees true or northwest, then if no Japanese ships were found, to return. But the launch itself, taking place at 2:08 p.m., was completely botched. Of the planned 16 Wildcats, only 11, under the command of Fighting 10 Executive Officer Lieutenant Commander William Killer Kane, took off. Of those 11, three missed the rendezvous with the other fighters and had to return to the Enterprise. Of the planned 12 Dauntlesses, only 5 took off, under Lieutenant Commander Thomas. Of the 7 Avengers, 6 under Lieutenant Albert P. Scoofer Coffin took off, though one suffered a bent wingtip during its takeoff run when the prop wash of the plane ahead of it drove its wing into the deck. Also taking off was Air Group 10 head Commander Richard K. Gaines, flying in the back of the formation and a command TBF to evaluate the attack and the damage caused, but with no command responsibilities on this mission. Commander Gaines may have wished he had command, however, because things did not get much better. Lieutenant Commander Thomas, assuming the Japanese carriers had continued steaming toward the Enterprise, led the attack group on a course of 287 degrees true, much closer to the southern end of the scout's search arc than the median. That may not have been an issue if the Japanese had indeed kept closing the range. At around 2:30, Army First Lieutenant John H. Bowie led a flight of 6 B-17s over Admiral Abe's vanguard force, where they made an unsuccessful bombing attack on the battleship Kirishima. At 3:10, Bowie reported that he had seen the Japanese headed back to the north. If the vanguard force was headed back north, then the carriers were too. They were not closing the range, but opening it. Thomas would never find them in his modified search, and in fact, the carriers were now out of range. Admiral Kincaid, not wanting to break radio silence, did not immediately recall the strike, figuring that with only a 150-mile leg, they would be back at their scheduled time, 5:35 p.m., just about sundown. However, after takeoff, Lieutenant Commander Thomas received garbled orders by radio that suggested to him he needed to take the strike out not 150 miles, but 200 miles instead. Given that 200 miles was the range for the scouting Dauntlesses launched earlier, it's easy to imagine that somehow their range was mixed in with Thomas' orders. What followed, however, was not. After having found no Japanese and perhaps thinking he had taken a strike too far to the south, Lieutenant Commander Thomas, on his own initiative, decided to take the strike out an additional 80 miles to the north. For those not mathematically inclined, the airstrike had traveled 280 miles, or almost twice what Admiral Kincaid had intended. Kincaid would later call Thomas' decisions here excess zeal. All that remained was to see how much of a price the excess zeal would exact. The return trip for the strike group was complicated by dwindling fuel, receding light, and an Enterprise that had to steam away from them to recover the scout Dauntlesses, which she did between 5:12 and 6:02 p.m., pulling the carrier an additional 20 miles away. The evening turned pitch black, with low clouds, haze, and no visible horizon. It was one of the scariest days of my life, Wildcat pilot Ensign Edward Whitey Feitner later said. I flew 10 minutes with my fuel gauges reading zero. The pilots kept formation by following the reddened exhaust stacks of the other aircraft. Flying at an altitude of 17,000 feet, to keep a lock on the Enterprise's homing signal, the Wildcat pilots ran low on oxygen and had difficulty transferring fuel from the wing tanks due to poor suction. The poor suction seems to have caused the F-4F of Lieutenant Don Miller to lose power some 40 miles short of the carrier. He waved goodbye and was seen to bail out, but that was the last anyone saw of him. A lack of oxygen was plaguing the Dauntless pilot by Ensign Jefferson H. Tiny Karoom. The oxygen system had sprung a leak, and flying at high altitude had caused him a splitting headache and drowsiness, symptoms of hypoxia. Sure enough, when the group reached the point where they thought the Enterprise should be, almost all of them found empty sea. All but Lieutenant Vetusa. As the SBDs jettisoned their payloads, in an attempt to squeeze more out of their remaining fuel, the resulting explosions revealed to him an oil slick. Remembering that the Enterprise had been trailing oil, he followed the narrowing oil slick in the dark and led the remaining aircraft back to the carrier a little after 6:30 p.m. But, just as Lieutenant Vetusa had warned, landing after dark was a completely new experience for most of the pilots. The result was mild chaos. Vetusa landed almost simultaneously with the F-4F, immediately behind him flown by Ensign Feitner, making his first night landing. Ensign Karoom, his judgment apparently clouded by hypoxia, disregarded a wave-off signal from the landing signal officer and came in anyway, bouncing off the Enterprise's island and plowing into a Dauntless that had landed ahead of it, trashing both and delaying landing operations until they could be cleared. Two SBDs and three TBFs were forced to ditch because their fuel ran out in the landing circle. Destroyers fished out all of the air crews except for Seaman First Class Arthur Browning of Torpedo 10. The airstrike had been a self-inflicted disaster. It had resulted in the loss of two lives, one Wildcat, four Dauntlesses, and three Avengers, while inflicting no damage whatsoever on the enemy. The pilots and Admiral Kincaid's staff started pointing fingers at each other over who was responsible for the debacle. Lieutenant Vetusa, much to his surprise, was never disciplined for his outburst at Admiral Kincaid's staff, probably because he had been proven right. Nor was Ensign Karoom punished, likely a recognition that hypoxia had impaired his judgment. It was a bad day all around. Losing 12 aircraft is not a good way to start a battle that everyone knew was close. The Hornet's captain, Charles Mason, felt like the night before the big game. Commander John Cromelin, the Enterprise's air officer, gathered his pilots in the wardroom for what was described as an excellent, earnest flight talk never forgotten by those present. In his Alabama accent, Uncle John, as he was known, declared, "This may be the beginning of a great battle. You men do not need to be babied, and I don't intend to hold your hands. We know that the Jap task force we are looking for will have a 3-to-1 superiority over us. Four of our PBY patrols sighted the Jap task force. You men will have the privilege tomorrow of proving the worth of your training, your schooling, our way of life against the Japs. The offensive strength we have in the Pacific is at the moment in the hands of you men in this room and of those on the Hornet. On you rests the safety of our Marines at Guadalcanal, who have fought magnificently. Last night they were bombarded again, and the Japs made an assault on our position, but they held, proving their worth. Wherever we have met the Jap at sea with our carriers, despite overwhelming odds, we have stopped them. The Japs are determined to drive us out of the South Pacific. If they get through to Guadalcanal with their carriers tomorrow, the Japs will take it. If Guadalcanal falls, our lifeline to Australia will be menaced. To stop them, you must knock out their carrier force. There's no room for waste and no excuse for misses. If you're going to miss with your bomb, you might as well stay home and let a good pilot take your place. We are on the right side of this war. God is with us. Let's knock those Jap bastards off the face of the earth." He closed his speech with a promise, "If you get back to the ship and into the groove, we'll get you aboard." Every aviator on the Enterprise knew the record of John Cromelin. No one wanted to disappoint him. As they slept that night, the crews heard his words ringing in their ears, over and over and over and over again. While Commander Cromelin was giving his rousing speech, Admiral Yamamoto was sending a message that, in its memo form, was not quite as rousing. 1. Army units plan to storm Guadalcanal airfield this evening at 2100. Accordingly, there is great likelihood that the enemy fleet will appear northeast of the Solomons. 2. The combined fleet will seek to destroy the enemy fleet on October 26th. 3. All forces will take appropriate action to 2 above. 4. Guadalcanal Support Force will operate as designated by Commander-in-Chief. It was left to Admiral Kondo to put the message in a more motivational form, which he sent out at 10:40 p.m. to the men under his command. "Commander-in-Chief Combined Fleet, orders that since there is a great possibility that we will engage in a decisive action, aircraft of all units continue searching and tracking operations regardless of weather and enemy planes in an attempt to discover the size and nature of the enemy forces. Aircraft were already doing just that, just not Japanese ones. Admiral Fitch had sent out a Catalina night tracker and 5 armed Catalinas to search out to 500 miles. The hope was that they could find the Japanese carriers in time for Admiral Kincaid to launch the strike group still spotted on the deck of the Hornet. When it became clear the Japanese carriers would not be in range that night, the Hornet was allowed to stand down, but her aircraft were kept armed, fueled, and spotted on deck for immediate launch. In this position, Admiral Murray suggested to Admiral Kincaid that the Enterprise continue providing air cover the next morning so the Hornet's pilots could get some sleep and still be positioned to launch immediately. Kincaid agreed. In the meantime, those PBYs were making nuisances of themselves. October 26th was but a minute old when the radar of a Catalina piloted by Lieutenant J.G. George Clute detected the enemy some 300 miles northwest of Task Force 61. Guided by radar, he honed in on what he believed was a cruiser and launched 2 torpedoes before exiting. The cruiser turned out to be the Japanese destroyer Isokaze of Admiral Abe's vanguard force. The torpedoes were easily avoided. It was Clute, apparently, who made a very helpful, laconic contact report, revealing he had met the enemy, but leaving out such details as its course, speed, and composition. "Air raid! Air raid!" The alarm had gone up on the Japanese carrier Shokaku a little before 3 a.m., Commander Takata ran to the bridge just in time to see in the moonlight some 5,000 meters astern 4 giant columns of water rise where the Zuikaku was supposed to be. Many a breath was held until the pillars fell away, revealing the carrier to be undamaged. The bombs from the Catalina piloted by Lieutenant Glenn Hoffman had fallen 300 meters to starboard. Then a flare burst, a brilliant tactic by Hoffman that blinded the Japanese anti-aircraft gunners long enough for him to escape. As he did so, at 3:10, he radioed a contact report to his seaplane tender Curtis at Espiritu Santo, the position of 1 large carrier, 6 other vessels on a southerly course, speed 10. Commander Takata stumbled down the ladder to his admiral's cabin, where Admiral Nagumo was conferring with his chief of staff, Admiral Kusaka. Takata reported the attempted bombing of the Zuikaku. Neither Nagumo nor Kusaka rose from their chairs. They just looked at each other and said in unison, "Let's turn around." In rapid succession came orders flashed from the flagship. All ships turn 18 degrees to starboard. After the turn had started, speed of advance 24 knots. Then, once the turn was completed, all ships of this force steady on course 0 degrees, true. Admiral Nagumo went on to order the ammunition and fuel removed from the aircraft on the hangar decks. They had been the death knell for his carriers at Midway. They would not be again. As the night went on, the Japanese naval commanders were informed that the Army's attack on Henderson Field had failed yet again. That defeat did nothing, however, to turn attention away from an engagement that now seemed imminent. At around 4 a.m., the flight crews and the carriers began preparing their aircraft using red-shaded flashlights for illumination in the dark. Admiral Nagumo, incongruously wearing snow-white gloves, always a necessity in the South Pacific, watched nervously from the Shokaku's bridge. At approximately 4:15 a.m., Admiral Abe's vanguard force launched 7 scout planes from the Tonai and Chikuma, then headed north to maintain station with the carriers. The scout planes were to search to the south, beyond Guadalcanal. A half hour later, an hour before sunrise, came Kitobutai's own search planes, 4 Kates from the Shokaku, 4 from the Zuikaku, and 5 from the Zuiho, searching out to 300 miles in an arc from 50 to 230 degrees true, generally northeast to southeast. The crews then prepared 22 fighters for a combat air patrol and 64 aircraft for the first air strike, the Shokaku with 4 escort zeros and 20 Type 97 Kates armed with torpedoes, the Zuikaku with 8 zeros, 22 Type 99 Vels, and 1 unarmed Kate to maintain contact, and the Zuiho with 9 zeros and 1 unarmed Kate as strike evaluator. The strike would be commanded by the Shokaku's veteran lieutenant commander, Murata Shigeharu. Then the Japanese simply hunkered down to wait. They didn't have to wait for long. At 6:58 a.m., the radios in the carrier Shokaku crackled to life. Large enemy unit sighted. One carrier, five other vessels. The report came from the Shokaku warrant officer, Ukita Tadaaki, flying a scout on the 110-degree bearing, slightly southeast, from Kitobutai, though Ukita used the wrong call sign, which confused matters and was bad form. After snooping around for a bit, Ukita amplified his report. Saratoga-class carrier, escorted by 15 other vessels, bearing 125 degrees, distance 210 miles. The skippers of the Kitobutai, who read the sighting report, groaned. They had expected the Americans to be ahead of them or even slightly to the right. Instead, the Americans were to the southeast. They had been about to ambush the Japanese. Admiral Yamamoto had been right. Now, after weeks of not knowing where the U.S. carriers were, they finally had them. They had a 64-plane airstrike ready to go. It could be in the air within 30 minutes. On the bridge of his flagship Shokaku, Admiral Nagumo smiled. It was 5:12 a.m. when the Enterprise picked up a rebroadcast from the seaplane tender Curtis, sitting in Espiritu Santo. One large carrier, six other vessels, on a southerly course, speed 10. The message, including their position, had come in at 3:15 a.m. Admiral Kincaid was livid. This report was 2 hours old. He had already launched his scouts, eight pairs of SBDs, each lugging a 500-pound bomb, covering 235 to 000 degrees true, southwest to north, out to 200 miles. If Kincaid had had this report, he would not have launched so many scouts, instead saving his Dauntlesses for an airstrike that he could have launched immediately. Kincaid himself may not have had the report, but several ships in his task force did, having picked up the original broadcast. They did not relay it to the Enterprise because they assumed she had picked it up as well. Admiral Halsey later called it a serious communication delinquency, a major understatement from a man not generally known for such. Even with this information 2 hours old, Kincaid's staff and pilots tried to get him to launch that Hornet airstrike that had been spotted the previous day. Kincaid demurred. They had lost 12 aircraft and two aviators that same previous day on a search-and-destroy mission. He would not risk them on such a mission again. Instead, the search Dauntlesses joined 10 Catalinas and 6 B-17s that had taken off at 3:30 a.m. for a dawn search. There were so many Japanese forces in the area that one couldn't help but stumble over one or more fairly quickly. Scouts Lieutenant Vivian W. Welch and Lieutenant J.G. Bruce A. McGraw were flying almost due west when, about 85 miles out, they found a Kate flying on an opposite course about 3 miles to starboard. Obviously, it was a scout, the number two scout plane from the Shokaku, to be precise. They ignored the enemy aircraft and continued on their way, and vice versa. At 6:17, the U.S. Navy pilots found two battleships, one heavy cruiser, and seven destroyers heading to the north at a speed of 20 knots. It was Admiral Abe's vanguard force. No carrier, though, so they continued on their way again. But after finding no carriers, Welch and McGraw headed back. They crossed Abe's force again, which, due to the sighting of enemy scouts, had changed course to 300 degrees and raised his speed to 30 knots. Angry at the continued harassment, the Tone and a few destroyers opened up on the two Dauntlesses without effect. As they continued on their way back, they passed by the same Kate, again headed in the opposite direction. Once again, neither side attacked the other. Their job was to scout, not to shoot. And as it turned out, the Kate had not spotted their carrier, either. Welch, McGraw, and their crews returned around 9:31 a.m. Admiral Abe had good reason to run away. Flying the adjacent search sector, north of Welch and McGraw, the SBDs of Ensigns Howard R. Burnett and Kenneth B. Miller also stumbled across the vanguard force. Burnett sent a contact report, then both dove on the Tone. Again, the Tone fired back. This time, the concussion of exploding anti-aircraft shells caused Burnett's Dauntless to spin approximately 4,000 feet before it could be brought under control and the dive re-entered. Burnett regained control in time to drop his bomb with Miller, though they both missed the Tone. They then returned to the Enterprise. But those were just appetizers. Lieutenant Commander Bucky Lee, commander of Scouting 10, was the senior search pilot that morning and had naturally assigned the juiciest search sector to himself. Lieutenant Strong had pulled Lee aside and told him, "I think you'll find the Yellow Bellies are in your sector. When you discover them, give us the word loud and clear." Strong was right. At 6:45 a.m., Lee and Lieutenant J.G. William E. Johnson stumbled across an aircraft carrier, At 6:50, circling 15 miles out, Lee, as Strong had requested, reported one carrier heading 330 degrees at a speed of 15 knots. In short order, he and his cohort found two more. But not only did they see the carriers saw them, too. The force changed course and made smoke screens. The Shokaku immediately launched 9 Zeros, followed by the Zuikaku with 8. These joined 3 fighters from the Zuiho, already in the air. Lee kept radioing in his find, but could not get an acknowledgement. Then the Zeros caught up with the 2 SBDs, which separated, trying to elude their pursuers. 2 Zeros hung on to Lee and chased him for 40 miles before giving up. Johnson had ducked into a cloud, then managed to drive off 1 fighter, which was immediately replaced by 5 more. Johnson successfully evaded them, and both returned to the Enterprise independently. The warning as to their presence and the fierce resistance it brought frustrated Lieutenant Commander Lee's plan to unite the search Dauntlesses in a dive-bombing attack on the Japanese carriers, but his repeated, if unacknowledged, sighting reports did result in more SBDs over Kido Butai, just as Lieutenant Strong had intended. Lieutenants J.G., Leslie J. Ward, and Martin D. Red Carmody moved east of the carriers, trying to get into attack position, but were themselves subject to a whipping counterattack by the same Zeros harassing Johnson. They were forced to turn back. Next to join the fray were Lieutenant Strong himself and Ensign Charles B. Irvine. They had picked up Lieutenant Welch's report and moved to intercept Admiral Ame's battleships until they picked up Lieutenant Commander Lee's report. Then, as Strong had intended, they moved to intercept Admiral Nagumo's carriers. Strong was still smarting after a verbal thrashing he had received 2 months earlier after merely reporting on and shadowing the Japanese carrier Ryujo and not dropping his bomb on her. He would not make that mistake again. While the covering Zeros were harassing Lieutenants Ward and Carmody, Lieutenant Strong and Ensign Irvine found 2 very large carriers separated by about 15 miles launching aircraft. Irvine followed Strong closely as they crept from cloud to cloud, stalking the nearest carrier. Positioning himself with the sun behind him and almost no wind effect, Strong reached his pushover point and took the plunge from 13,000 feet, followed quickly by Irvine. They both aimed for the forward part of the flight deck, decorated with a large rising sun as a means of identification, which was, to the Americans, a conveniently placed target. Hell divers, the Japanese called these Douglas SBD Dauntless dive bombers, the same ones who had screamed from the sky to bring death and destruction at Midway. Then it had been too late when the lookouts had spotted the Dauntlesses. Zeros had gone into maximum climb, gunners had frantically trained their anti-aircraft batteries upward, but it had been to no avail. And here screamed the hell divers again. The panicked, pathetic defense at Midway looked masterful compared with today. Stunned, stupefied, at the hell diving from the clouds yet again, the Japanese gunners got off a burst or two of wild anti-aircraft fire, more for the principle of the thing than anything else, while the fighters were nowhere to be found. It was just a dive bomber's paradise, something that you dream about, hope to see maybe once in your life, Lieutenant Strong later said. The howling, picture-perfect plunge from 13,000 feet ended below 1,500, where Strong released his bomb, quickly followed by Ensign Irvine. It was Lieutenant Strong's gunner, aviation radio man First Class Clarence Garlow, who rendered the verdict. "Your bomb was a hit, Mr. Strong," Garlow said. "Mr. Irvine got one, too." To show their appreciation of the success of Strong and Irvine, as the Dauntlesses pulled out of their dives amidst heavy but inaccurate anti-aircraft fire, the Japanese, in the words of Strong, had a reception committee waiting for us of 12 Zeros at the bottom of the hill. The 12 gradually dwindled to 3 angry Zeros from the Zuikaku, led by Lieutenant J.G. Yoshimura Hiroshi, who chased the pair for 50 miles as Strong and Irvine practiced a version of the scissoring maneuver introduced by Lieutenant Commander John S. Jimmy Thatch, formerly of the Yorktown, by which 2 aircraft would weave back and forth, one trying to lure a chasing attacker into the sights of the other. Effective with forward-firing fighters, it worked even better with Dauntlesses that could fire to the rear as well. Lieutenant Strong's bomber was perforated in the rear, but a Zero flown by Seaman First Class Nakagami Koichi misjudged and pulled up to make another pass too soon. "Right then I laced into a burst of fire," said Garlow, the SBD's rear guns lashing into the belly of Nakagami's fuselage. The gasoline started shooting out, and he hit the water hard and burst into flames. After some 45 minutes of this chase, Strong and Irvine lost the two remaining Zeros in a squall. Having cheated death once, as they headed home, they sought to cheat it again. Irvine called back to his gunner, aviation radio man 3rd Class L.G. Williams, who himself had perforated a Zero, and asked, "I feel like a smoke. What about you?" Lieutenant Strong thought his target was the fleet carrier Shokaku. It was actually neither the Shokaku nor her sister Zuikaku, but the light carrier Zuiho, sister to the Shoho that had been sunk some 5 months earlier, the news of which was shared with the memorable phrase, "Scratch one flat top." And with this attack on the Zuiho, the U.S. Navy would scratch one more flat top, at least temporarily. One of the bombs had blown a 15-meter hole in the flight deck far aft, destroying 3 Zeros parked there, wrecking her arresting gear, and starting a small but obnoxious fire. Overall damage was light, and the Zuiho's survival was never in doubt, but the bomb had struck a tender spot on the light carrier. Her wrecked arresting gear could not be repaired at sea, and without it she could not recover aircraft. This remarkably effective attack had left the carrier useless for the current operation. An extremely annoyed Admiral Nagumo ordered the Zuiho to leave her fighters behind while she broke off for truck. The sneak attack further agitated Admiral Nagumo and his chief of staff, Admiral Kusaka. After the first strike had launched, Nagumo watched impatiently as Kusaka kept pushing everyone on the Shokaku to work faster. The Zuiho's plight conjured up images of Midway, with fully armed and fueled aircraft in the hangars that the Helldivers had turned into weapons against the Japanese carriers. Fueling operations for the second wave on the Shokaku and Zuikaku immediately stopped, and in an almost panicked reaction, the fueling carts were pushed overboard. Then the crews had to go faster and faster under the whipping tongue of Admiral Kusaka to get the second strike ready. Lieutenant Shingo Hideki, the fighter squadron commander, would lead 8 Zeros in escorting 20 Val dive bombers under Lieutenant Commander Seiki Mamoru. Deciding not to wait for the Zuikaku to finish arming 14 K torpedo bombers, Nagumo launched the Shokaku's part of the airstrike, starting at 8:10. Now, with two airstrikes away, there was very little left to defend Kido Butai from air attack. But Admiral Kusaka did not care. Described by one author as cautious and outspoken by nature, Kusaka was normally very outspoken about the need for caution. Not now. While Kido Butai had turned sneak attacks into a science, as with Pearl Harbor and Darwin, they did not much appreciate the same skill in their opponents. The sneak attack that had cost them the Zuiho brought up bad memories of Midway that left Kusaka seething. "Bring spears, enemy," Kusaka hissed. "Anything!" Lieutenant Commander Lees was the first fresh information on the Japanese carriers this morning, and Admiral Kincaid was determined to act on it. The Admiral's staff plotted the location as bearing 300 degrees true, distance 185 to 200 miles, a distance that would increase because the Japanese carriers were now heading north. At 7:08 a.m., the Americans changed course to 330 degrees true and upped speed to 27 knots to close the range on the Japanese. A little after this, the heavy cruiser Northampton used flags to signal to Admiral Murray that she had an unidentified radar contact 28 miles to the southwest, odd since neither the Hornet nor the Enterprise had the contact on their radar. The blip circled all the way to the southeast and closed to 20 miles. At 7:37, the battleship South Dakota radioed that she had detected Japanese radio chatter. Somehow this information never made it to Admiral Kincaid. On orders flashed from Admiral Kincaid, Admiral Murray had the Hornet turn into the wind, which involved basically reversing course, and from 7:32 to 7:43 a.m. launched the original moonlight strike she still had spotted on her flight deck. 15 SBDs of Bombing 8 and Scouting 8 under Lieutenant Commander William J. Gus Widhelm, 6 TBFs of Torpedo 6 under Lieutenant Edwin B. Iceberg Parker, and 8 F-4Fs, each with a belly tank, of Fighting 72 under Lieutenant Commander Henry Sanchez. Captain Mason returned the carrier to the 330-degree course and prepped the second wave for launch. At around the same time, the Enterprise turned into the wind to launch her second air cover of the day of 11 Wildcats. She also slapped together some aircraft for an air strike of her own. Preparations such as they were strongly suggest a last-minute improvisation, as much to clear the flight deck of planes as to hit the enemy, opined the respected Pacific War historian John Lundstrom of this strike. It comprised 3 SBDs of Bombing 10, flown by pilots of Scouting 10 under Lieutenant J.G. George Glenn Estes, 8 TBFs of Torpedo 10 under Lieutenant Commander Jack Collette, and 8 F-4Fs of Fighting 10 under the irrepressible Lieutenant Commander Jimmy Flatley, flying with a broken foot. Enterprise Air Group leader Commander Gaines once more joined the strike in a command TBF as strike evaluator. Admiral Kincaid had given the strike verbal orders to rendezvous with the Hornet strike if feasible, but as the pilots took off from the Enterprise, they saw a placard that read, "Proceed without Hornet." Nothing like a little contradiction in orders to start the day. The Hornet strike passed the Enterprises as the latter's was forming up. The savvy veteran, Lieutenant Commander Flatley, had a bad feeling about not joining with the Hornet's group. At least the first Hornet group. There was also the second Hornet group, which the carrier had quickly armed, spotted, and launched, completing all by 8:10 in an admirably efficient performance. This second wave had 9 SBDs under Lieutenant John J. Lynch, 9 TBFs under Torpedo 6 Executive Officer Lieutenant Ward F. Powell, curiously armed with bombs instead of torpedoes, and 8 F-4Fs, but one of the fighters had to immediately return when the oil pressure went out. The Hornet Air Group skipper, Commander Rohde, joined this group as strike evaluator in a command adventure known as the Sea Hag. 3 groups of attack aircraft from the Hornet and Enterprise had launched, 3 airstrikes, in theory, each acting independently, making no effort to coordinate with the others. The eminent Guadalcanal historian Eric Hamill pointed out, there was no U.S. doctrine allowing the subordination of one air group commander to another, nor the meshing of squadrons of one air group with like squadrons of another. Not yet, anyway. Hamill went on to comment, the U.S. strike groups went off as a stream of separate mixed units, each one composed of whatever aircraft happened to be available at the time of the launch. Indeed, each of the 3 strike groups lacked internal cohesion. Each was itself strung out over distances of several miles. In fairness, the Hornet's first group had been planned and spotted since the previous day, but one could argue the Enterprise strike fit this description. In fact, most of the U.S. airstrikes after Coral Sea would fit at least one element of this description. It had carried a price at Midway. Would it now? Lieutenant Commander Widhelm's group from the Hornet was in the lead, but had fractured. The bombers and 4 fighters were at 12,000 feet, while the Avengers and 4 fighters hugged the sea under 1,000 feet, each group losing sight of the other. Behind them, and to starboard, was the Enterprise strike. 4 fighters from Fighting 10 on either bow above the Avengers. They were about 60 miles from the Hornet when Ensign Phil Souza, flying a Wildcat in the back of the formation, saw something curious a few miles away to starboard. Aircraft, a lot of them, flying in the opposite direction, towards the Hornet. They were not friendly. "Hey, Johnny," Souza called to his section leader, Lieutenant Thomas C. Johnson. Souza also alerted Lieutenant Commander Sanchez. Sanchez, in turn, radioed the Hornet, 24 dive bombers, red base, approach, stand by for bombing attack. Lieutenant Commander Widhelm also radioed a warning. Ominously, neither received an acknowledgement. What Ensign Souza had seen was Lieutenant Commander Murata's 20 Kates and 4 Zeros from the Shokaku and 9 Zeros from the Zuiho. Though most of the Dauntlesses missed seeing the Japanese, Lieutenant Commander Widhelm, Ensign Souza, and others eyeballed the passing enemy strike, keeping their guard up and their tail guns trained on the Sea Eagles. Murata and some of his pilots returned the favor. Like the Old West, it was rival gangs passing each other, staring each other down, waiting for one wrong move, one glance, one turn, one shot, to begin a free-for-all. But they were professionals. They had their orders. They were to attack the enemy carriers. Everything else was only chicken feed, to use Lieutenant Commander Widhelm's term. They now knew that neither side had really gotten the jump on the other, although the Japanese had launched about a half hour earlier and had a significant edge in numbers and striking power. All they could do was wonder if, once the mission was complete, they would have a ship to which to return. To help make sure he did, Lieutenant Commander Murata radioed the Shokaku that 15 enemy bombers were coming. Above Murata, the flight from the Zuikaku missed Lieutenant Commander Widhelm's flight entirely. For that matter, Murata's flight missed the Avengers from the Hornet passing below them. But the Japanese strike still had 2 approaching American air formations inbound, over each of which they had the advantage in numbers. Next in line were the Avengers and the few escorting Wildcats the Enterprise had quickly slapped together. Having just formed up and still gaining altitude, almost all of their radios were still turned off. While radio silence had been ordered, airstrikes usually did not keep it. The silence was disconcerting to Lieutenant Commander Collette, leading the Enterprise's torpedo bombers. He asked his aviation radio man, First Class Tom Nelson, if the radio was broken. Nelson checked. Someone had changed the channel away from that used by the torpedo bombers. Typical. Someone always changes the channel and never tells anyone. Nelson turned it back. Bogies! The yelp had come from the newly adjusted radio, for all the good it would do. The Avenger started to shiver, its right wing dipping. Nelson looked to starboard to see Lieutenant Commander Collette's wingman, Ensign Robert E. Oscar, with a look of sheer horror on his face. Smoke began to fill the compartment, flames gushing from the engine to the cockpit. Nelson called to Collette, but there was no response. Collette had already bailed. Nelson tried to help the turret gunner, aviation metalsmith First Class Stephen Nadison, Jr., get out, but Nadison had not put on his parachute harness. There was no time. The Avenger was corkscrewing into the water. Nadison signaled to Nelson to go. Nelson parachuted to the water. Neither Nadison nor Collette was ever seen again. They never saw what hit them. It had been Lieutenant Hidaka Saneyasu, leading the nine zeros from the Zuiho, who had been escorting Lieutenant Commander Murata's strike. He had watched Lieutenant Commander Windhelm's Hornet strike pass without orders from Murata to attack. That just would not do. Presumably, Hidaka decided it better to apologize later than ask permission now. He would only perform a hit-and-run on them. Then he could return to guarding the Type 97s. What could go wrong? From higher altitude, Lieutenant Hidaka split off from Lieutenant Commander Murata and had his zeros form a line and loop a 180-degree descending turn behind Torpedo 10. Attacking from out of the sun, Hidaka's fighters dove on the unsuspecting Avengers. With their Wildcat escort on either side in front of them, Torpedo 10 was literally blindsided. No American saw Hidaka himself target the lead Avenger of Lieutenant Commander Collette and set fire to the engine. The next one to go was the Avenger of Ensign John M. Reed. Turret gunner, aviation radio man, Third Class Murray Glasser, saw pieces of plane fly past him, and then sensed fire licking him. Reed shouted over the intercom, "Bail out! Bail out!" Glasser was the only one to escape before the TBF exploded in midair. Behind Reed, aviation radio man, Third Class Charles F. Schinneman, the tunnel ventral gunner on Lieutenant McDonald Thompson's TBF, saw Reed's engine coming by our wingtip, the prop still spinning. Schinneman then saw holes like live coals in a piece of paper appear inboard on the port wing of Lieutenant J.G. Richard K. Batten's Avenger. The damage caused a fire in the wing's hydraulics, which caused the port aileron to stand straight up. Batten's tunnel gunner, aviation metalsmith Rexford B. Holmgren, called out, "Mr. Batten, our wing is on fire." Batten dropped out of formation and announced on the radio he was going to ditch because the TBF was burning. However, the fire burned out, the aileron fell off, and the Tough Grumman kept on flying. Unable to jettison the torpedo because of the loss of hydraulics, Batten turned around, hoping to make it back to the Enterprise. The Avengers of Torpedo 10 were in trouble. But the Grumman TBF Avenger was a relatively new aircraft. Its first combat had only been at Midway back in June, a last-minute addition to the atoll's defenses. Today would be its second major action, operating from carriers, the first being Eastern Solomon's. The Japanese in general had little experience against the Avenger. Like most American aircraft, it was a tough bird. It was also blessed with ample rear-facing weaponry, the 50-caliber dorsal turret gun and the 30-caliber ventral tunnel gun, as Lieutenant Hidaka's pilots were about to discover. The first to learn this was Petty Officer 3rd Class Takagi Shizuta, one of Lieutenant Hidaka's wingmates. As Takagi dove from the starboard quarter, the turret gunners got the range with their 50 calibers. At a range of 100 yards, Takagi's Zero burst into flames and started losing altitude as he continued firing into the wing of Lieutenant Marvin D. Norton. Finally, the Mitsubishi pulled out about 50 or 75 feet above the flight and exploded in a fireball. It was a spectacular way to go. And it may well have been what attracted the attention of the Wildcat mother ducks that a snake had snuck up behind them and was gobbling their ducklings one by one. On the left, the veteran Lieutenant John Jack Lepla led three green fighter pilots. He ordered them to drop wing tanks to increase their maneuverability. Preparing to get into the fight, Ensign Willis B. Chip Redding dropped his wing tank. His engine promptly lost all fuel suction, sputtered, and died. not the way he wanted to start this aerial battle. As Ensign Redding's Wildcat plunged toward the ocean below, Ensign Raleigh Dusty Rhodes, his own drop tank not releasing, and ultimately set afire due to Japanese bullets, followed Redding down to see what he could do, which was not much. In the meantime, the Zero shot off most of his instrument panel, his canopy, even his goggles, all without even scratching him. The electric gun sight hung by its wiring, which was just as good because his guns were now useless. But the plane kept flying. Redding was finally able to get his engine restarted just in time to be narrowly missed, as Rhodes had been, by the falling wing tank of Ensign Albert E. Meade, Lieutenant Lapla's wingman. So far, it was not a good day for wing tanks. The issues with the wing tanks cost Lepla, who also had a malfunctioning gun, and his pilots, any chance of a coherent response. Worse, they had still not reached altitude, so the tried-and-true tactic of diving to gain speed to pull away from the Zeros could not be used. They were on their heels. On the starboard bow of the beleaguered Avengers, Lieutenant Commander Flatley was maneuvering to stay in position when he saw the carnage behind him. Flatley ordered his Wildcats to drop their own wing tanks and then charged in. Only one Zero was within range, that of Petty Officer Third Class Matsumoto Zenpei. The entire flight of four Wildcats combined to bring him down. But that was all they could do. Lieutenant Thompson was now the Avenger last in formation. He called out to Ventral Gunner Shinneman, "Zero coming up underneath us!" The Zero, flown by either Lieutenant J.G. Utsumi Shuichi or Petty Officer First Class Kawasaki Masao, charged up and fired, missing astern. As the fighter pulled away, Shinneman put about a half canister of 30s into his cockpit. He drifted off on a wing below us and out of sight. Lieutenant Thompson led the remaining Avengers in forming up with the Dauntlesses. It reminded Lieutenant Commander Flatley that he was on an escort mission. He was deeply frustrated that he and his men had not been sufficiently alert, but he had to protect the strike aircraft, and so Flatley made the agonizing decision to leave Lieutenant Lepla and his struggling Wildcats cut off far behind Flatley to their fate. It was not long in coming. Lieutenant Hidaka and his wingman, Petty Officer First Class Mitsumoto Jiro, had Lieutenant Lepla and Ensign Meade by the throat. The beleaguered Americans practiced a version of the weaving tactic pioneered by Lieutenant Commander Thatch, but one in which Meade did all the maneuvering. Lepla seemed to fly straight ahead, and I don't believe fired a shot, said Meade. I shot for both of us, and believe I got three. He got one, either Utsumi or Kawasaki, who joined the fight unseen and was shot down unseen. But the odds were too great. Ensign Meade heard popcorn popping as Japanese bullets hit the back of his armored cockpit. His instruments were shattered and his ankle was injured. Then a head-on attack from either Hidaka or Mitsumoto finished off his fighter, forcing Meade to nurse it into the water. Some distance away, Ensign Rhodes was trying to nurse his shattered F-4F back to the Enterprise to show the guys. Rhodes managed to reunite with Ensign Redding, and they too performed Lieutenant Commander Thatch's scissoring that baffled their Japanese pursuers. Rhodes glimpsed what he believed to be Lieutenant Lepla's Grumman. It was in deep distress, with a Zero coming from the front and a Zero on its tail. Later, Rhodes glimpsed a parachute. He hoped it was Lepla. Rhodes's engine burned out and froze at 2,500 feet. As he tried to ditch the Wildcat, Japanese bullets severed his rudder cables. That was it. Rhodes remembered his old flight instructor had emphasized, never attempt to bail out under 500 feet. But his flight instructor was not here to scold him. Rhodes popped open his canopy and deployed his parachute, which pulled him up out of the cockpit and set him hard but safely into the water. Ensign Redding tried to keep watch over Rhodes, but the three Zeros on his tail had other ideas. Redding pushed his engine to full power and hit the deck. With his electrical system down, he could not fight back, but Rhodes noticed that one of the three Zeros chasing Redding was smoking. Though Rhodes had glimpsed a parachute he thought was Lieutenant Lepla, the inertness of Lepla's Wildcat made Ensign Meade suspect he was dead or unconscious in the cockpit. Like an aerial El Cid, Lepla's Wildcat just kept flying, quivering slightly. It was never seen again. The Enterprise strike had been roughly halved. Three Dauntlesses, four Avengers, and four Wildcats. Three Wildcats and two Avengers shot down. One Wildcat and two Avengers damaged enough to turn back. Five men dead, four in the water. Lieutenant Commander Flatley's fighters were now severely restricted in their options because Lieutenant Hidaka had forced them to drop their wing tanks early. As for Lieutenant Hidaka, he had indeed made one pass at the Enterprise strike just as he had planned. It had cost him almost half his command, much of his fuel, and almost all of his ammunition. He decided he could not catch up to Lieutenant Commander Murata and ordered the five remaining Zeros to head back to Kido Butai, where they told tales of fighting six Grummans and eight Dauntlesses.